Hello, and welcome to the Leap of Faith. The question this evening, what did Martin Luther ever do for us? As the 500th anniversary approaches of the symbolic publishing of his 95 thesis in Wittenberg, we've gathered a panel this evening to learn more about this German Augustinian monk, a somewhat obscure professor of theology in a little-known university, and to discuss the implications of his actions. Well, joining us from our Belfast studio this evening is the Reverend Dr. Martin Cowan of Union Theological College in Belfast. Before his appointment at Union, he served as assistant to the vacancy convener in the First Presbyterian Church, Portadown, and was a teacher at Cornhill Training College in Belfast. Here in the studio, Dr. Alison Horrestal, who studied at St. Patrick's College, Maynooth University, and is an historian and senior lecturer at NUI Galway, but her home is in County Wicklow. And also in the studio, Professor Dara Kyo, Professor of History and Deputy President of the Dublin City University, and also served as President of St. Patrick's College in Drumcondra. You're all very welcome to the Leap of Faith.
Thank you, Mike.
So,
thank
I suppose you. We should really start by not making an assumption that everybody knows who we're talking about when it comes to Martin Luther. Alison, can I throw to you first to maybe set him in context for us, who he was and where he came from?
Well, Martin Luther is somebody who lived 500 years ago, but is one of the few people in history whose name has resonated through history over the last 500 years. And this year is the 500th anniversary of the publication of the 95 Theses that he wrote around October 1517, and which pushed him from a position of relative obscurity in a small town in Saxony, in Germany, in the Holy Roman Empire, to what was at the time worldwide fame within a few years. And that was really why the name Martin Luther has come to mean so much in history. He was an Augustinian friar who was brought up in Saxony, and he ended up in Wittenberg in the early 1500s, where he held a position at the University of Wittenberg, which was quite a small university at the time. And in 1517, Martin Luther came to the attention of local church authorities, his bishop, when he wrote a series of theses for debate within Wittenberg and perhaps more regionally as well. And in those 95 theses, he took to task particular practices that were very popular within society at that time, and which were practices that were promoted, encouraged and endorsed for the most part by the Catholic Church, of which almost everybody in Western Europe and Central Europe would have been a member. When we think about Christendom, if we think about Christendom in the early 16th century, we're thinking of a Catholic Christendom and effectively a Europe in which Catholicism was the Christianity of the time.
So what we're looking at is a massive organisation. They decide they want to do some renovations to St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, and they need money.
Yes, effectively. The indulgences that were being sold in Saxony at this time were indulgences from which the money to be taken would go for the ongoing construction project of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. And some of the other half of the money was to go to pay the debts of Luther's bishop. Indulgences were a really common practice within the late medieval church, which is still the church of the early 16th century. What they were was a payment which would be made with the approval of the Pope in order for the temporal punishment of sins to be foregone or to be retracted or reduced. What had happened, though, over the course of a couple of hundred years was that the payment for indulgences came to be associated with the reduction of the time in purgatory. And purgatory was a very widespread belief. It wasn't a belief that was dogmatic, but it was widely accepted in the same way that, say, something like limbo, which older Irish people might remember, had become not a formal dogma of the church, but widely accepted. So Luther's problem with indulgences was, number one, the fact that so much of this money was being used for what he really considered to be unchristian practices, really, which is, you know, sort of the great building works of the papacy. But he also began to have significant problems with what indulgences stood for. And what indulgences stood for was a belief that Christians were saved by faith and works. So indulgences and the prayers that went with them, pilgrimages, the use of relics, almsgiving, all of these things were considered to be works that Christians carried out in faith, but were works which would contribute to their final destination.
Tara Keogh, if you want to expand on that a little bit for us, because here sounds like, in fact, just a malcontent employee who decides to lash off a couple of swift words within his own circle. But he starts more than he expects.
Yeah, I think it's more fundamental than that. I mean, taking up Alison's point about indulgences and time in purgatory, that if you put yourself back in the context of the early 16th century, that people are obsessed with salvation, that people are faced with their mortality on a daily basis. I mean, you've come through a century of plagues and Black Death and so on. People's mortality is all around them. So people worry about salvation in a way that we don't. If you think of people listening to the show, if people ask themselves, you know, how many of us are likely to go to hell? I don't think any of us, some of us maybe should, but I don't think that any of us engage with those questions now. And that, I think that's one of the big issues for Luther, that for Luther, the question is about salvation and about the salvation of his soul. And his objection, I think, to the sale of indulgence is precisely that the bar has been lowered, that there's been cheating going on here. And that there's that sense of, I suppose, indignation and sense of been cut out. Maybe Martin.
Yeah, let's bring Martin Cowan in on this one from our studio in Belfast. Martin, has that particular theme come all the way through to the present day in the Reformed Church?
Yeah, I think it certainly has. Luther is so alarmed by what's happening because he himself is in a process of personal evolution. He's working towards his own conversion experience. In many ways, the penny hasn't dropped for him. The lights haven't come on when he goes to promulgate the 95 Theses. But one thing he certainly knows is that repentance is important. And the way that Johann Tetzel peddles these indulgences seems to downplay that. And for Luther, it all seems like cheap grace.
You also have a situation, though, that he originally published these in Latin, and so therefore was expected that he was having the debate amongst other theologians. The trouble began, apparently, when he brought them down to 20 and put them in the vernacular in the German language.
Yeah, they certainly took on a life of their own and started to snowball very quickly. Luther made great use of the printing press, both by producing things in Latin, which would appeal to preachers in the parishes, and then subsequently being able to write more brief pamphlets, which were easy to publish and distribute. And many of these documents took on a life of their own and were transmitted around Europe very quickly. Looking back later in his life, Luther said it was as if in 2 weeks they had spread right across Europe.
It's almost the original going viral, isn't it? Do any of us know what actually Rome's initial reaction was to him?
Yes.
Alison.
As Martin said, the theses are printed very, very quickly, multiple editions of them. And an awful lot of these early copies survive, which is one indicator of that certainly there were a lot of editions. They're very well thumbed as well. So they were certainly circulating very, very quickly. They were sent to Rome by the bishop's officials quite soon after Luther produced them. And over the course of 1518, slowly Rome began to pay some attention to this. But there is a sense, I think, early on, and Dara and Martin would have comments on this as well, I think that Rome was not really sure what it was dealing with, and that the cardinals in Rome assumed that this was really just a sort of some scholarly friar
in
Wittenberg,
yeah.
And that it would probably calm down pretty quickly. Mm. But over the course of 1518, we begin to see public disputations being organised. And what we have to remember, too, is that there's an important political context here. And the papacy already had an envoy in the German lands at this time, who had been sent over to deal with, to be the papal representative for the election of the new Holy Roman Emperor, and also to gather tax for a proposed crusade. So this individual was placed in charge, effectively, of investigating Luther at this point. Now, this was Cardinal Cajetan. He was actually very moderate in his approach to Luther. He came from a humanist background, which meant that he had some sympathy with the new humanist learning. He had called for reforms within the church himself. So he took quite a moderate approach to begin with, but he is soon joined by the more zealous and those who very quickly begin to, in some ways, defend the church, but also, I would go so far as to say, making a career for themselves as opponents of Luther.
So if Luther hadn't existed, would somebody else have taken this baton and run with it?
I think one of the curious things is that there's almost an assumption that Luther came out of no place, or that Luther was the first person to protest, or that Luther had started something. I mean, we'd seen medieval equivalents of Luther. You'd seen Huss, or you'd seen Wycliffe, or so on. Mm-hmm. The difference in the past was that there was in that kind of unity of Christendom, there was a consensus. So you had, in a very simple way, church and state singing from the same hymn sheet. Alison has spoken about the election of the Holy Roman Empire. Europe is in a very different place in 1517 than it had been before. At one level, you had the Turkish terror, for instance. So you had the Turks threatening Eastern Europe moving forward. You had, a Holy Roman Emperor, the election of a Holy Roman Emperor. You had the Habsburg family anxious to establish themselves in that space, to create a kind of a super empire. And then at a local level in Germany, you had the emergence of a sense of a proto-nationalism or kind of state formation. So when Luther begins his process, it very quickly escalates into a debate, really, not about the issue of salvation, but about the issue of the authority of the papacy. Mm-hmm. And things escalate really very badly because of bad handling, I think, on the Roman side.
Yeah. Martin, can I go a little further now from Luther and the start of the movement of this Reformation through Calvin and Knox?
Sure. So that's of particular interest to me. Of course, the reform which is happening at this time is not confined to what Luther is doing in Saxony. Almost simultaneously in Zurich, Zwingli is there. There's a reform movement in another part of Switzerland with John Calvin. Things are changing in England as well, and in Scotland, and a number of English and Scottish exiles find refuge in the continent. So some, particularly from England in Zurich, and are heavily influenced by that form of the Swiss Reformation. And then for Irish Presbyterians, the fact that John Knox comes to Geneva and finds there what he regards to be the most perfect school of Christ on earth since the time of the apostles. That's incredibly formative because that's the form of Protestantism, that reformed branch, which is brought back to Scotland and then in time to Ulster.
And it's important to recognise that this isn't a bloodless event. I mean, this is a time with a great deal of violence even associated to it.
There are two things to note. Martin draws important attention to that the patterns, if you like, that are emerging as the movement begins to fragment while simultaneously consolidating. And the development of a reform wing, if you like, in multiple territories is something that takes place over the course of about 40 years or so, really, from the 1520s up to 1560. And very quickly, yes, not only do we see the emergence of strands of reform, some of which owe more to Luther than others, but we also see the development of effectively military political blocks on either side.
Derek.
Yeah, I think it's important in that context that Martin has spoken about, say, the development of the Reformation, but we don't have a single Reformation. At one level, you have a succession of Reformations, and the schoolish view would be that Luther came and created the Reformation. But in some ways, Luther himself is part of a medieval Reformation, that Luther was part of a reform branch of the Augustinians. So they were reforming themselves, and a very little human vignette that when Luther went to Rome in 1510 to visit, the story is that he was scandalized by what he saw. But he stayed in Santa Maria del Popolo, in the wonderful convent. It's famous for the Caravaggio paintings, but he stayed in that convent. And I often think that in 1510, when he had his breakfast, at that breakfast table, Luther was there as the young friar who was disillusioned, who went on to create the Reformation, that the prior of the house was a man called Giles of Viterbo, who led the reform branch within the Augustinians itself. And there was a young Spanish friar at the table as well, Jerome Serapando, who went on to become papal legate to the Council of Trent. So here are the three boys eating their panini together in Rome. So we talk about the Reformation as if it came from no place, but it's part of a long, long development. And I think we have to see it in that human context and grappling with the issues of salvation.
Can I go back to you for a moment, Martin? And now let's take the progression further, because what I'm curious about is that we have the Reformation stalling when it gets to the rest of Ireland, other than the north of Ireland and the Pale. What happened?
This is a fascinating question, and there are many issues to do with why the Reformation was not as much as a success in Ireland as it was in other parts of Europe and in other parts of the British Isles. One key role in it is the use of the Irish language and to what extent the Reformation was spread in quite an English way across Ireland, hence accounting for its lack of success. And another factor is to do, I think, with the degree of political control that there is right across Europe. The Reformation, it prospers in areas in which there is a civil magistrate close in hand to help facilitate it.
What did we end up as fundamentals then in the Reformation, Martin? What did it boil down to that Reformed Church held as fundamental?
Again, this is an interesting question because, as was said by Dara a few minutes ago, Reformation movements had been around for many, many centuries. There were Reformations plural, but at the same time, something happened early in the 16th century, which was significant enough to account for the massive disruption that there was in the church at that time. And I think it's particularly to do with the theological ideas which were recovered and stated with a new degree of clarity and precision at the time. And those became some of the key fundamentals of what Reformed and Protestant churches were like. For me, they're not simply abstract ideas that historical theologians are interested in. Those great doctrinal debates really turned around some of the most fundamental questions that I think any person asks. How do we know what's true? And again, that's going back to some of those early debates with Luther that he had with Cajetan and particularly with Eck, the matter of authority. Then that question of what is it that's wrong about us? Luther said that our hearts are turned in upon themselves. There's this selfishness within us. How do you account for that? Then the key question of how does someone actually receive the grace of God? Everyone in the church is convinced that God's grace is essential, but how is it received? And then what does vocation look like? What does it look like to live a life that pleases God day by day?
Dara, you wanted to come on this?
Yeah, I think the question about whether the Reformation succeeded or failed in Ireland is important. I mean, I think you have to see it in the context of politics, that for many that the Protestant Reformation in Ireland was perceived as a colonising effort. There's no question about that and was resisted as such. There's also a big disjuncture with the past that if you think of the, say, enthusiasm for the book as opposed to, say, faith and good works, in an Irish context, I think that the Catholic Church plays that very well, because they were able to, one of the things I think in terms of the St. Patrick myth in a way is the way in which kind of pagan Ireland was brought in or baptised under St. Patrick. So there was this continuity around pagan places that became places of pilgrimage. So for instance, the destruction of relics and so on in the context of the Reformation was an emotional breach with the past, and the Holy See's decision, for instance, to renew the indulgences associated with pre-Christian and Christian places of pilgrimage. So the question is, did Protestantism fail in Ireland or did Catholicism succeed?
Well, many houses would have had a Bible, but they would not necessarily have studied it every day and no chapter and verse in it. They would have left that to their priests to interpret for them.
But
at what stage do you mean in the 19th or 20th century?
Yes, even up to today.
It's true, I think, that within the Catholic Church in Ireland and within Catholic society, there hasn't been a strong tradition over the last century or two of people reading the Bible for themselves. That's true. And there are lots of reasons for that. Changing rates of literacy are one thing. But there are other reasons for it as well. And I suppose it is really post-Vatican II that we begin to see much greater emphasis on direct reading of Scripture in the vernacular. But Luther... And this goes back to what Dara said earlier. Luther does not emerge from nowhere. He comes from within a reforming late medieval age, if you like, and several groupings who'd been involved in that. So he is, of all of the reformers, although he looks very radical in some ways, he is astonishingly conservative in lots of ways. His existential crisis in the 1610s in many ways continues as an existential crisis right into the 1520s as he struggles with adaptations to doctrines and ideas that inform his self-identity very strongly.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that what Martin has spoken very clearly about, say, John Calvin and the kind of systematic reflection and practice that he brought to the Reformation. And that's particularly important. But it's valuable at the same time to look at the other side in the so-called Catholic Counter-Reformation, or what people maybe now call the Catholic Reformation. The Council of Trent itself is a great example of reform and bringing a kind of systematic renewal to the Church. But also the individuals like St. Ignatius, again, can be held up as somebody who gives us a model of Catholic education, the spiritual exercises, a whole kind of way of behaving. And significantly too, that Ignatius himself and the initial Jesuits were dismissed as the Jesuiti or the Jesus freaks. And there was even a question about, well, were they Protestant or were they Catholic? What were they? So it's not as clear cut, but I think that what you can see on both sides is really this is about modernization. And it's moving out of the medieval into the...
So the Reformation was not only having now an effect on those that were following it, but it was having an effect on everyone else.
Sorry, if I can come in, yes. Yes, it does. But as Dara said, it's really important to emphasise, I think, that when we talk now about Catholic Counter-Reformation, we talk also about Catholic Reformation. I would probably view the Council of Trent more negatively than Dara has said. To me, there are a lot of... things I don't like about the Council of Trent. Well, I would look much more positively at the more organic movement within Catholicism, which preceded the Council of Trent and which had many parallels with Luther's own growth in the early 1500s and 1510s. And we see the emergence of, groups like the early Ursulines, the Capuchins and the Jesuits as well, none of which are founded in reaction to Protestantism. They actually precede or coincide alongside it, but quite independently, really. So like Luther, they owe a great deal to the religiosity of the late 15th and early 16th century.
Martin, what was the legacy for Protestantism in this case?
Well, it's fascinating. The legacy lives on today in parts of Belfast. On gable walls, you can see images of Martin Luther armed with his hammer going to make a point, nailing up the 95 Theses. And that idea has almost taken on a mythic character within Protestantism, and I'm particularly interested in the way in which this story has been twisted and perhaps even distorted down through the centuries as each generation takes and appropriates the Reformation, both to use it and also to abuse it in many ways.
I think Martin is absolutely right, and I think that's something that when, like we all do here, when you know a lot about the Reformation, it becomes ever more evident when we see the ways in which the Reformation has been used, and in particular Martin Luther in the 95 Theses. The Reformation is not all about liberation and liberty and forward thinking. It is the 16th century is an age of enormous intolerance, persecution. You might call them some of the birth pangs, if you like, of the modern age, but this is not a straightforward process by any stretch.
Well, let's bring it forward to as we come to the end of the programme. I was interested to read recently Bishop Brendan Leahy, the Bishop of Limerick, writing that today the Catholic Church is focusing again on reform. Are we in another Reformation?
Well, it can't come too soon for me in that sense. I say that slightly flippantly, but I would welcome greater emphasis being placed on issues that are really quite serious issues for modern day Catholics. And I think that the Catholic Church has never been fast moving in any of these issues. It doesn't treat conservatism and tradition as dirty words, because they are inbound with the identity of the Catholic Church, institutionally, theologically, governmentally as well. But certainly I think there are areas here where wholesale reform is not only desirable but necessary.
Martin?
Well, certainly from my perspective as a Presbyterian minister, I would hate if our celebrations of the Reformation at all gave out the impression that we think the Reformation has nothing to say to us today. I think the big questions that it raised about the place of the Bible within the church, the way in which the gospel of salvation is proclaimed, I think they're as relevant for Protestants to think about as any other part of the church.
Yeah, I think that Martin is absolutely right there, that when you use the term Reformation and speak about the Reformed Church, there's almost an assumption that there's perfection. But Martin's point is exactly there about the need for all churches to continue to reform themselves. I think fundamentally the question about salvation is critical for all Christian denominations, that I think that churches need to engage again about what does it mean to be saved. If churches don't do that, I think there's a question about, well, what are they? But I think from the point of view of the Catholic Church, it's very interesting that the Pope took Francis as his name. Is it akin to Francis of Assisi, who was a medieval reformer, who again rebuild my church? Is it St. Francis Xavier, the Jesuit, who was again part of that whole movement? And certainly in the rhetoric, the Pope's rhetoric, it's about again the kind of bark of salvation. It's about the field hospital for the wounded. The whole language again that he's using is bringing us back to a purer, less institutional type faith.
I'm conscious that we've also painted a picture of Luther and left one particular part out, which is the anti-Semitic teaching that would have been present for him in his writing.
Yes, I can comment on that. There are a number of things to say. Number one, yes, he says awful things about them over the course of his career, particularly in the early 1540s, around 1543, when he writes a text called On the Jews and Their Lies. The second thing is, though, that Luther probably never met a Jew in his life. So it was quite abstract. And also he did so on the basis of theological principles rather than biological principles of race, which would have been the way that 19th century anti-Semitism developed. And the third thing to remember, really, is that Luther would not have been thinking very differently from a lot of other people in Europe at that time. So we have to contextualize him when we write that. It is very unfortunate that he wrote these things. He was a marvelous communicator, but he was prone to becoming extremely impassioned, both in speech and in writings. And he became increasingly frustrated as his life went on about the failure of the Jews to convert. And I think that he allowed this frustration to overflow into very shocking language now, and also very shocking ideas about what should be done with Jews.
Reverend Dr. Martin Cowan, Dr. Alison Forrestal and Professor Darragh Keogh, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith. And before we leave you this evening, a quick reminder that Dr. Art Hughes, who's a reader in Irish at the University of Ulster, this Thursday presents a documentary on the 500th anniversary of Luther's Reformation. You can see it this Thursday at 10:15 on RTE1 television. From all of us here, goodbye.